It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, it's Wisconsin Life and a look at an inspiring journey by sea. First, it's time to talk 2016. As expected, Hillary Clinton is running. She announced yesterday in a video featuring a variety of Americans in different transitional periods in their lives. She, too, she says, in a transitional period, she's running for president. Florida Senator Marco Rubio also told supporters this morning that he's joining the race. He'll make that official in downtown Miami tonight. He's the third Republican entering the ring following Rand Paul last week and Ted Cruz a couple of weeks ago. Here with us to make sense of what we're seeing so far in terms of communication styles, media strategies, is Mike Wagner, assistant professor in the School of Journalism at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Hillary Clinton's announcement has probably been the least, I don't know, conventional so far. She released a 2-minute video yesterday in which she only appears for about the last 30 seconds. Here's a clip.
I've started a new career recently. This is a fifth-generation company, which means a lot to me. This country was founded on hard work, and it really feels good to be a part of that.
I'm getting ready to do something, too. I'm running for president. Americans have fought their way back from tough economic times, but the deck is still stacked in favor of those at the top. Everyday Americans need a champion, and I want to be that champion.
Hillary Clinton's campaign announcement. I mean, we've been waiting on the edge of our seats. Is she running? Is she running? Is she running? Well, she's running, and it turns out to be this almost inconsequential video that announces it. Why this sort of softball approach?
Well, Hillary Clinton is a known commodity, and so she doesn't need to have a big event where she also takes questions, because questions from the news media are a much less controlled environment than a video. And so here she's using the other people in the campaign announcement video to tell the stories that are framing what she says the campaign ought to be about. She talks for a few seconds, and she's trying to communicate a few things, the economic message that she has, and that she's not taking this for granted. She's trying not to make it about her, responding to some of the critiques that she received in 2008 when she was not successful in securing the Democratic nomination. But mostly this is about safety. If I don't appear in front of reporters, I can't get asked hard questions or make a gaffe.
And would you assume that at this point she's got some of her strategy hammered out, and this video about economic equality kind of putting her as a celebrity in the back burner is a template for what the rest of the campaign's going to look like?
I imagine that's their plan right now, but as the former boxer Mike Tyson used to say, everybody has a plan until you get punched in the mouth. And so until something happens, until a Democrat throws his or her hat in the ring to run against Hillary Clinton, she'll have her plan that she wants to go ahead and move forward with, talking about economic inequality, talking about her qualifications, talking about the stories of the everyday Americans she says she's fighting for. So we'll see a lot of that from her until she's forced off script.
And one challenge, I imagine, is to reintroduce her. She's been introduced. She's, you know, had her debutante ball, so to speak. Not a great allegory for the first potential woman president. But, I mean, how do you get her out there again and make her fresh?
Well, she's gone to hire consultants who are good at doing just that. One of the people she hired is one of the people who's kind of been behind kind of the public branding of the First Lady Michelle Obama. And, you know, Michelle Obama is one of the most admired figures on planet Earth. And so that group has done a good job introducing the First Lady to the world. And Hillary Clinton is using that same person to kind of reintroduce herself. There's always the issue of how many reintroductions can a known commodity have. And this was a problem Al Gore ran into in 2000, where people had known him as a senator, they had known him as vice president, and then the campaign made something out of him now wearing earth tones on the campaign trail, and people started wondering, well, who is this guy? Why do we keep having to reintroduce ourselves to someone we know? And so former Secretary Clinton is going to have to make sure that she communicates her record, which she has as a lawyer, a first lady in Arkansas, a first lady of the country, a senator, and the Secretary of State, and whatever new things she wants to present to the public, because elections are, or politicians at least believe elections are about the future, and she's going to talk a lot about that.
We're talking right now with Mike Wagner, assistant professor in the School of Journalism at UW-Madison, taking stock of the known candidates' strategies so far as they announced for president, starting with Hillary Clinton. And also today we have Marco Rubio announcing he's running. He's going to give a talk tonight in front of the Freedom Tower in Miami. He's the third Republican in the ring. What do you make about how he's handled it so far and his plans for the rest of the day?
Well, he's tried to walk the line of being relevant in the modern world with the way his social media has started. But he's also doing a traditional kickoff because he's just a less well-known commodity nationally than someone like Hillary Clinton is. And so he needs the event. He needs to have video on the television news with the cheering background and him giving a soundbite and a speech about what it is he's all about. People who do know him might remember him from giving the Republican response to the State of the Union a few years ago, where he famously reached off camera to grab a bottle of water. But he's also trying to, in recent days, communicate to a younger audience. He was on The Daily Show fairly recently, you know, which is not a place most Republican presidential candidates love to go. And so he's trying to find a way to connect with younger members of the party as he introduces himself to the country.
Now, his announcement came right on the heels of Hillary's announcement. Is that intentional? Is he trying to either ride some of those headlines or maybe take away some of her press?
I don't know that they're doing too much of that because right now they're talking to different audiences. Hillary's primary audience right now are Democratic voters in the Democratic primaries, and Marco Rubio's audience is Republican voters in the Republican primaries. And they're communicating to the same news media. And so, you know, there is the idea that Rubio's announcement today makes Clinton's announcement a little bit more older news, and so she'll get less coverage in the mainstream media than she might have if Rubio didn't announce today. But, you know, on the list of things that matter with respect to who wins the presidential nominations, when you announce is pretty close to the bottom.
I was going to ask you how much it matters, both how you announce and when you announce. I mean, is this really going to matter as we get into the thick of it, the nitty-gritty, these first announcements?
Not really. What matters is how these candidates appeal to people in their party who decide who the nominees are going to be, elected officials, key members who kind of run, you know, city, county, state-level parties, people who donate lots of money to campaigns, people in the invisible primary that we don't always see on election day are really consequential. And so how Senator Rubio and Secretary Clinton and Senator Cruz and Senator Paul are appealing to the key members of their party is going to be really important. And we'll see some of that covered in the news media. We'll see some of that in polling. But what really matters is who's endorsing them, who's throwing the weight of their endorsement behind these candidates, at least at this stage.
Now, given the number of likely candidates on the Republican side, what kind of media strategies do candidates have to pull together if they really want to have a shot at that nomination?
Well, they need to show the party insiders that they're viable. So they have to get good coverage from the national media. They want to have polls that show that they're competitive in the primary, but also against Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side. And they want to, you know, post good numbers when they're reporting their fundraising, when they start to have to report those kinds of numbers. And so if they can do those things, those are all stories. Those are all reasons to get attention. And once the debates start, you know, in several months, then it'll be a lot easier for them to get attention. But right now they need something good that shows they're a viable candidate if they want positive attention. There's plenty of ways to get negative attention, but they want positive attention.
Yeah, I was going
to
ask you about negative attention. Rand Paul got some negative attention mm-hmm. in the media last week for being kind of confrontational with an interviewer on the Today Show. Does sort of negative or controversial attention like that, does it still sort of play to the adage, you know, all publicity is good publicity?
Well, what's really important there is the audience, right? So Savannah Guthrie is asking Senator Paul questions, and he pushed back pretty aggressively on the Today Show. And some people were really turned off by that, but a lot of Republican voters who believe the news media are a bunch of liberals like the fact that he pushed back against that. And so the people he has to appeal to now, conservative Republicans who vote in primaries, were the kind of people who are receptive to questioning the motives of the news media when they seek to ask questions of candidates for president.
So as you look here at the beginning of the race for a lot of folks, we've talked about Rand Paul and Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, Hillary Clinton. What kind of advice would you give them this time around? We're in a slightly different world. Last time, Barack Obama was considered a revolutionary for his use of the social media, mm-hmm. the grassroots organizing, and that's even more so times whatever now. What kind of advice would you give in that world?
Well, it's important to stay relevant in that world. It's a great way to raise money, and it's a great way to organize volunteers. And the Obama campaign has been outstanding at those things. And they've also were very good at identifying voters who might vote for them but weren't yet locked in to vote for them. And that's something, you know, that the Clinton campaign can certainly learn from, just as the campaigns on the Republican side can learn from. And so identifying how do we figure out who are our supporters and making sure they get to the polls, and then finding out who might be our supporters and how can we knock on their door, call them, send them literature, send them emails to make sure that they are in our column on the primary or caucus day in that particular primary.
And we'll leave it there. Mike, thank you so much for coming in again.
My pleasure.
We've been speaking with Mike Wagner, assistant professor in the School of Journalism at UW-Madison, about the communication strategies we've seen so far from the four candidates who've entered the ring for the 2016 presidential nomination. Time for Wisconsin Life. A discovery on Lake Superior Beach has brought a popular old children's book to life. As Glenn Moberg reports, the search is on for the person who built a small wooden boat similar to the one in the book Paddle to the Sea.
The boy came running over the slippery ground. He was just in time to see the canoe slide down into the rushing water.
Jeffrey Hinneber always liked Paddle to the Sea, about an Indian boy who releases a miniature hand-carved canoe on Lake Nipigon with dreams that it would travel across Lake Superior to the Atlantic Ocean.
Ho, he called. You've started on your journey. Goodbye, Paddle to the Sea. It's a wonderful book, wonderful maps of the Great Lakes and mapping of the route where the wind and waves may have pushed this little boat.
Hinneber says he can't get enough of the wind and the waves and the beaches of the Big Lake. It was last July that he made his discovery.
We were on York Island. It's a big crescent beach on the north side of that island. And a good 10 yards up the beach where storms had thrown a bunch of driftwood, I saw something that had more of a symmetric shape.
It was a 10-inch long, hand-carved wooden boat with a weathered inscription on the bottom.
I could clearly make out that it said Lenny, and then there was a last name that was obscured. It had a P.O. box, but the numbers were not legible. And then finally, it said Cornucopia, Wisconsin.
In the book, a sea captain finds the little canoe, fixes it up, and sends it on its way.
So that is how Paddle got a new copper rudder that would not rust, new paint, with the canoe bright red.
Jeffrey Hinneber, who builds kayaks, did the same with his little boat.
I did paint a little red stripe around the entire boat to give it a little more pizzazz. And engraved a brass plaque that included the information about my finding it where and the release date.
Hinneber's discovery caught the eye of Ruth Opedal, executive director of the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin.
Kind of reminded me of Paddle to the Sea, and I just thought, wow, this is a great watershed story.
Opedal says with a watershed like Lake Superior, it really could happen.
It's possible. That's why it's called a watershed. Possible drop of water that falls in Lake Nipigon can make its way out to the Atlantic Ocean.
The question Ruth Opedal wants answered, who is Lenny?
Oh. Well, you know, when I saw a picture of that boat and I saw Lenny, I thought, you know, that's a traditional name. That sounds like something that was carved maybe 40, 50 years ago.
Opedal thought it might be Leonard Isaacson, who owns a 90-year-old lumber company in the South Shore community of Herbster. But Isaacson says he didn't carve it.
Well, I have carved little boats, but nothing like that. You know, what Leonards or Lennies would be here in the last 50 years or more, and I don't know any.
So for Jeffrey Hinneber, it's just another Lake Superior mystery.
The lake is phenomenal in its pristine beauty. On the eastern shore, there's pictographs, sacred places, and islands that were revered by First Nation peoples.
First Nation people who traveled the Great Lake in carved wooden boats.
Yes, little traveler, you made the journey, the long journey. You now know the things I have yet to know. You are truly a paddle person, a paddle to the sea.
Now, the boat that Jeffrey Hinneber found is back in Lake Superior on its own long journey. And there is much about this story that we have yet to know.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org. And now for all canoe lovers, it's a classic love story. Girl meets boy, they fall in love, get married. And for their honeymoon, they build their own canoe and paddle 1,700 miles from Lake Superior to the far reaches of northeastern Saskatchewan. Our next guest did just that. Joining us now to talk about her adventure is Julie Buckle. She's the author of Paddling to Winter, a couple's wilderness journey from Lake Superior to the Canadian North. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica. It was really fun to hear that paddling story. Previous to this, Ruth Appadel is a good friend and from this region originally, so I haven't heard her voice in a while, so that was great.
Right. Well, obviously some echoes with your own story here, a canoe going on an ambitious journey. How did you ever get this idea to go 1,700 miles from Bayfield, Wisconsin to northern Canada?
Well, the idea really started with my husband. And when I met him, we were living in Washington, D.C. And after one of our first dates, I was at his house, and there was a map on the wall, and it had all of North America, and there was this yellow, highlighter line that went from Lake Superior all the way up into northern Canada. And at that point, I was a farm girl from Wisconsin. I had never paddled a canoe, actually. And I asked him what that line was about, and he said, "That's my dream trip. I want to paddle from Lake Superior all the way up to northern Saskatchewan." At that point, I just thought, well, you might as well just go to the moon. That's just impossible. You can't possibly do that. And, of course, we continued dating, and he introduced me to paddling, and it was something I took well to. It's a lot like farming. You got to just keep at it and keep plugging along. And so... when we were talking about getting married, I threw that out. I said, well, how about if we do that dream trip of yours for our honeymoon? And so that's what we did.
What'd he say?
You know what's really funny is he spent 6 months really trying to vet me. And because he had done longer expeditions, and he wanted to make sure I fully understood what it meant to commit to a trip of that length. But he didn't understand that he was talking to a farm girl, and we don't quit.
So what made you guys decide to build your own canoe? Nowadays, you can buy a canoe that's going to be pretty good. Why did you decide to do that part of it, building your own?
But it's such an incredible experience to, for one, make something that's aesthetic and beautiful. And if you're going to be paddling in it for 4 months at a time, I personally just wanted something I really wanted to look at and to feel the cedar beneath my feet if I was barefoot, we were never thinking about an aluminum canoe, but we had a plastic one that we paddled. And then Kevlar, of course, is the canoe of choice among many because it's lighter and it is durable. But the thing that really kind of sold us ultimately on the wooden and canvas, one is that we were really looking at historic trails. This was a route that the voyageurs traveled for hundreds of years. And so it was kind of a nod to the voyageurs and this historic route that we were going to be traveling. But also, we had talked to people who paddled wooden canvas canoes and are big wooden and canvas canoe fans and had actual stories of being able to fix the canoes on the trail. If you wrap a Kevlar boat around a rock, there's just, your trip is over. If you wrap a wooden canvas canoe around a rock, you have a shot at being able to fix it, particularly if you've made it. So we understood the construction of the boat. We understood the boat so well, and it really was an extension of us on the trip. It was our home.
Well, we've got to hear something about that actual trip. What was it like to be on this epic canoe journey that far north?
It was extraordinary. And I have to say, people wonder, like, would I do it again? And this time of year, I get hankering to do it again. The physicalness of being out day after day and living on the land and going with the light and going with the seasons, there's really no other way to get at it. And of course, for me anyway, the more challenging part was that winter portion when we were done traveling and we were sitting on a remote island in a little teeny cabin in winter in northern Saskatchewan, and because we had to learn how to sit still. So the moving aspects was really particularly fantastic.
How long did it take you, all in all?
Well, we spent 4 months paddling the Voyager route, and we landed in Wollaston Lake, and then through some serendipity, landed in a cabin on an island. The people who were living there, we had stopped to visit them because people had told us we had to stop and visit Felix and Linda Fisher on Estevan Island, and we stopped to say hello and go on our way, and here they invited us to stay, and we ended up staying with them for a week, and then they were leaving, so they asked if we'd like to stay in their cabin, and so we did.
Mm. Well, before we let you go, what's the thing you miss most about being on the water every day like that?
Oh, well, there's so many things. I still, 15 years later, look at the lake every day and wonder, is this a good paddling day or not? But it's the relationship building. You know, I was never, have never been, and I don't know if we'll ever be as connected with my husband. It was a great way to start a marriage. We were fully immersed in each other as well as the landscape.
Oh, sounds magical. Julie, thank you so much for joining us.
You are so welcome.
That was Julie Buckle. She's the author of Paddling to Winter, a couple's wilderness journey from Lake Superior to the Canadian North. The internet has brought us a lot of good things. Our access to recipes, movie credits, shopping has never been better, but there are downsides. One of those downsides, according to our next guest, is that the world of the online amplifies our power to publicly shame people. He says an offensive tweet or a minor scandal may be deserving of criticism, but things have gotten way out of proportion. In his new book, John Ronson interviews people who have been at the receiving end of the global shaming machine about how it affected their lives long after the initial outcry died down. John Ronson is a journalist, documentary maker, and author. His newest book is called So You've Been Publicly Shamed. He joins us now from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio. John, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, nice to be here.
Well, John, shame has always been with us. It's part of history. What's different about shame and shaming in the modern era that got your attention?
The renaissance of shaming on social media is, I think, way worse than it's ever been for so many reasons. It stays around forever. It's wildly out of proportion to the crime. People are being destroyed for bad phraseology. Somebody tells a joke that lands badly, a kind of liberal joke that lands badly, and they are defined for the rest of their lives by some bad phraseology. And then I would meet these people. I would do what nobody else would do, which is actually journey to their homes and meet the people that we destroyed, and they were crushed, they were mangled, and it's carnage.
Well, it's an interesting thing because it seemed like at first this could have been a good thing in your mind, as though justice was being democratized, giving voice to the voiceless and all of that, and then you had your own firsthand experience with public shaming. What's changed in your mind about the way you've thought about it?
You know what I think the problem is that you're right. I mean, we shame people appropriately and we have power in a way that we haven't had power before. So, for instance, I mean, I can think of a million appropriate shamings. Let's say when the NYPD put a man called Eric Garner in a chokehold and he died and nobody was indicted. And as a result of social media, there were protests and they were powerful. And now my guess is that the next time the NYPD has somebody in a chokehold, they might think twice. But I think the problem is that we cannot differentiate on social media between an appropriate shaming and an inappropriate shaming. Our ferocity, you know, the heat of our flame is just as strong for somebody who deserves it as doesn't deserve it. And so somebody making a gag, a liberal joke that comes out badly, gets utterly torn apart. So that's what changed it for me. I'll give you an example.
Sure.
Okay, a woman called Justine Sacco. I mean, she's really kind of ground zero of social media shaming. Just before getting on a plane to Africa, she tweeted, "Going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS. Just kidding, I'm white." So what she was trying to do in a very badly worded way was make a kind of, you know, joke about privilege. She wasn't trying to gleefully flaunt privilege. She was trying to make a joke about privilege in much the same way as You know, Randy Newman would do in his songs, or South Park. But while she slept on the plane and was completely oblivious, her tweet went around the world. Millions and millions of people read that tweet and just decided that she was a racist monster who had to be fired, and also had to be defined forever by that tweet. And the fact that she was oblivious to this destruction was part of the hilarity, the fact that we were about to watch this woman get fired in real time before she even knew she was being fired. It's so profoundly undemocratic and so profoundly unjust.
And you talked with her. How did this experience affect her after the outcry was over?
Crushed, I mean, broken. I met her in a bar a couple of weeks later. You know, she had barely stopped crying for weeks. It mangles your mental health. She said she would wake up in the middle of the night forgetting who she was. She thought if she was in an accident and lost her memory and then came back and Googled herself, that would be her new reality. She was the monstrous racist AIDS tweets woman. Not only was she fired, but the newspapers were following her to the gym. Almost nobody was defending her because people were too scared to, because social media can be so ferocious. The language that's used is so ferocious. It's like the bullies took over the school.
We're talking with John Ronson now. He's the author of So You've Been Publicly Shamed, talking about the shame culture that we live in online right now. And John, you didn't speak with her in time for your book, but when we think about public shaming, Monica Lewinsky comes to mind, and she recently did a TED Talk about her experience. Here's a clip.
This scandal was brought to you by the digital revolution. It was the first time the traditional news was usurped by the internet for a major news story. What that meant for me personally was that overnight, I went from being a completely private figure to a publicly humiliated one worldwide. I was patient zero of losing a personal reputation on a global scale almost instantaneously.
A clip there from Monica Lewinsky's TED Talks. Now, you talked with her a while back. What did she tell you about what that experience meant to her and shaped her?
Funnily enough, I could tell how vulnerable Monica still was, because I met her a week or two ago and we did an interview together for VanityFair.com, and she wanted to interview me about my book. And whenever I tried to talk to her about what happened to her, she kind of said, oh, you know, let's talk about that another time. So she was still, I think it took an awful lot of courage for her to stand up and give that TED Talk. And I thought she did an absolutely beautiful job. You know, there was a line in that TED Talk that really touched me after being a journalist for 30 years and also somebody who's been writing about public shaming for the last 3 years. She said something like, people forget that I am dimensional and there was a time when I wasn't broken. And there's a game being played on social media where we all pretend that everybody's either... We don't know it's a game. We've kidded ourselves into believing it's real life, where everybody is either a magnificent hero or a sickening villain. Everybody's either just the best person ever or the worst person ever. But we know in our hearts that human beings are dimensional. We're clever and we're stupid. We use good phrasing and we use bad phrasing. We are honest and we make mistakes. And yet, on social media, we've created a stage for these artificial high dramas that that are incredibly damaging for the people at the centre of them.
It is high drama, and it seems as though it might be hard to turn the ship on something like this once it gets going. But, you know, speaking about Monica Lewinsky, she has been speaking out against the culture of public humiliation and trying to get people to back off it a little. Do you think there's hope for that to happen in the age that we live in?
Well, I hope so, but there's a bit of messenger shooting going on too. You know, I'm getting the odd. It's funny, for 30 years I've been writing about abuses of power, about powerful people doing crazy and absurd things. For me, the first time ever that I've been really criticised for it is with this book, is when I'm saying, you know who are the powerful, crazy people now? Us. It's like people love it when I say that about the pharmaceutical industry in my book, The Psychopath Test, or, you know, powerful elites in my book, Them. As soon as I say we are the powerful, crazy people now, a lot of people try and, you know, muddy my name. So whether it's going to make a difference, I don't know. But I will say that, you know, if you read my book, which is quite a sort of dreadful experience. You know, people tell me that their heart pounds when they read this book. You know, they feel the anxiety of what it is to be at the end of one of these shaming campaigns. I think if you read my book and if you watch Monica's TED Talk, which explains, you know, what it feels like so beautifully as well, I think it's going to be harder to shame people, because once you've visited the slaughterhouse, it's kind of harder to eat the steak.
Well, another aspect of this, which could point people in that direction, is the work of a psychiatrist named James Gilligan, who says there's a link between violence and shame. What has he found?
Oh, he is such a smart man, James Gilligan. This is a Harvard psychiatrist who, for the first part of his life, just treated, as he described it, normal neurotics like you and me. And then he got himself involved in the maximum security prison world in Massachusetts, because there'd been an epidemic of violence and killings. People were killing each other in the most awful ways inside prison. So he went in to try and make sense of it. And to cut a long story short, what he discovered, as he said to me, was that every single murderer he spoke to had a central secret. And that secret was that they felt ashamed, deeply, chronically, profoundly ashamed, because as children, they'd been beaten, scolded, abused, insulted physically and mentally. And it's no coincidence, he said, that the people who occupy the most violent spectrum in adult life, were treated equally violently as children. And Gilligan said something to me which I thought was so profound and beautiful, and something that, you know, we should all remember, which is that he said all violence is an attempt to replace shame with self-esteem, which isn't to excuse violence, but it is to understand it. And so while we are knee-jerk, trigger-happy shamers on social media, Gilligan's work is so important in reminding us that even the worst people, the people in maximum security prisons who've committed murder, benefit from empathy.
Hearing that, and the stories of the people that you speak to, is shame ever a useful emotion? Given that it may lead to violence, that it ruins people's lives, is shame useful? Does it have a public corrective that is useful to society?
You know, when I was in the bubble of writing this book, when I was hanging out with people like James Gilligan, I was rather convinced by the idea that, you know, shaming is never good. You know, the only way to get out of this sort of, you know, echo chamber of shaming is to just step out of it and refuse to shame. But now that the book's out, I sort of feel that maybe that's a bit Disney. And, you know, every day there's another shaming on Twitter. And just today there was a horrible photograph went around Twitter of a woman hunter who shot a giraffe and was lying jubilantly next to the body of the giraffe. And when I saw that, I was, you know, like everybody else, I was horrified. And you know, I was very careful in my book to only write about people who I felt their punishment was disproportionate to their crime, ordinary people whose transgressions were very slight. I mean, one message of this book is that shaming is an incredibly powerful thing, you know, very powerful. It mangles people's mental health. And the power is in our hands now, because everybody is scared of us on social media. So it is our responsibility to be judicious, to use our shaming wisely, because there's no rule book right now. So we have to make the rules ourselves. So I think, you know, there are appropriate shamings, but there's an awful lot of inappropriate ones too.
We're talking right now about a new culture of public shaming with John Ronson. His new book is called So You've Been Publicly Shamed. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think we're too quick to shame people for their tweets, their misjudgments? Do we remember that people are multidimensional? And does the punishment fit the crime? Call 800-642-1234. We're continuing our conversation with John Ronson. His new book is called So You've Been Publicly Shamed. He looks at the modern day culture of shaming, talks to people who have been the subject of outcries on social media, and says the punishment for minor offenses can get way out of proportion with the original crime. You can join in. Have you ever done this? Have you piled on in an online scandal? Do you agree that there can be a tendency to overreact, or have the rules changed so we should all just be more careful? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR is our Twitter handle. And we go now to Dennis. Dennis joins us from Red Granite. Hi, Dennis.
I just think if people go out there and put things on social media, they're opening themselves up. They're putting their life out there for public to see. And if they say or do something stupid, what do they think is going to happen?
All right, Dennis. Thanks. Dennis, pretty much in essence saying live by the sword, die by the sword when it comes to social media. What do you make of that, John?
You know, I don't buy that for a couple of reasons. Firstly, because when Twitter started, it was really a kind of, it felt like a sort of Garden of Eden, you know, the silence had a voice. People were finding their voice, and it was like an eloquent voice. It was a leveling of the playing field, and it was kind of beautiful. People, and, you know, why take that away from people, you know, the chance to be able to broadcast their voice in an eloquent and funny and passionate way? And secondly, Justine Sacco, the woman I talked about earlier who did the bad joke about AIDS, she had 170 Twitter followers. Nobody ever replied to her tweets. Like when the New York Times phoned her up to fact check my book extract, they said to her, were you surprised before you got on the plane that nobody replied to your joke? She said, nobody ever replied to my joke. So I really don't think it was unreasonable for Justine to not expect, while she slept on a plane, for her life to be utterly destroyed. You know, she shouldn't have needed to expect that would happen.
Well, thank you for the call, Dennis. And we're going to go next to Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Well, hi, Veronica. You know, something happened with my, well, I was reading a friend's Facebook account, and you know the singer Michelle Schock?
Uh-huh.
Well, she supposedly, well, she made these comments at a concert, which made it sound like she was this horrible homophobic person. And everybody on the Facebook account was just saying, oh, how could she be this way? I've never, you know, I can't believe she turned into this raving maniac. And she like had all her concerts canceled. And I just looked a little deeper into the story, and she made the statement that to me totally explained why she said that. She was just being sarcastic. She didn't really, those weren't her beliefs. And I believed her. And I posted that on that Facebook account, and nobody spoke to me again. And I just felt like it was an example of how people will read something online and they don't really know much about it, but they just instantly make a decision about it. And I don't know why that is. I feel like people are just thinking more superficially than they used to, or maybe it's when they're just on the internet. I don't know, but, and yeah. I don't know whatever happened to Michelle Schacht. But
got it. Thank you, Sarah. Appreciate that. And
I can answer the second part of that conversation, that question, because Michelle Schacht actually came to my event a couple of days ago in Los Angeles.
Oh, what'd she say?
Well, I didn't talk to her, but I saw her sitting in the audience. I know that I'm sure that she regrets the comments that she made on stage, and I think she hasn't been able to get any bookings for the last couple of years as a result of them.
Do you think that people are too quick, you know, just read the tweet, a few lines of text there, and then make a decision instead of looking for the context, the multidimensionality that Monica Lewinsky was kind of talking about there?
Yeah, we are on social media. We are like toddlers crawling towards a gun. You know, we have these knee-jerk responses to some phraseology that, you know, it doesn't matter if it's taken out of context, doesn't matter if it's nuanced, but the nuance doesn't come through. You know, we're just in love with what we believe is attacking people who are misusing their privilege, but actually what it is just beating people up.
Why do you think that is? I mean, do we get pleasure out of that? Do we like to see people punished? Does it appeal to some sort of reptilian part of our brain that likes things to be very black and white?
Sometimes I think it's like it's just the desire to do good, to be seen to be empathetic people. It's always, you know, the people who are shamed these days are people who are seen to have misused their privilege. And of course, that's a better thing to shame somebody for than, you know, the things that we used to shame people for in the 19th century, like, you know, adulterous affairs or whatever. But the problem is we're so in love with getting people who have misused their privilege, that we've really let our standards slip. We're getting people for anything, and then we just excuse it as they're another person misusing their privilege. You know, so sometimes I think it's the desire to be seen to be empathetic that's leading us to do these incredibly unempathetic acts. Other times I think it's just cruelty. Sometimes I think it's just people who prefer ideology over humanity, and that's always dangerous. When other human beings are just a blank canvas for you to put your ideology onto. I think some of that goes on social media too. It's terribly destructive.
Let's take another call here. Josh is with us in Madison. Hi, Josh.
Yeah, hi. I had a question for your guest as to whether or not he thinks that, or what he thinks of public officials that deserve shaming, but appear not to be effective or act like they're not. Do you think that they, on some level, they do feel shame as a result of a shame campaign in a situation where maybe they might deserve to be shamed?
So Josh, I guess, kind of saying that with some public officials, I'm not sure who in particular he's thinking of, but maybe there's cause for shame and some people don't seem to feel it.
I mean, my theory, you know, my last book before this one was a book about psychopaths called The Psychopath Test. And you could say that psychopaths don't feel shame. They don't feel remorse or anxiety or guilt because that part of the brain underperforms, whether it's through nature or nurture, is, you know, the jury's out. But honestly, I think those people are really few and far between. I mean, you know, they say that 1 in 100 regular people is a psychopath, which means 99 out of 100 aren't. And my guess is that a public shaming is an incredibly powerful weapon, incredibly effective. And I think, you know, the vast majority of people get really hurt by it. And one of the great ironies of this, of course, is that, you know, there's a woman in my book called Lindsay Stone who made a joke at Arlington Cemetery, which, my God, she's paid for. She posed in front of the silence and respect sign in front of the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier as this kind of douchey joke. She pretended to shout and flip the finger. This was like a running joke where she would pose in front of signs and do the opposite. Such a lovely woman. Her job was to work with adults with learning difficulties. And the joke, you know, backfired, and she was publicly shamed across the internet, fell into deep depression, didn't leave home for a year and a half. One of the ironies of that is that it's the sweetest people who suffer the most when it comes to a public shaming.
Do you think it's just that in that instant, captured forever, that something can never really be seen in its entirety? That moment, say, with Lindsay might have been a second of a joke with a lot of respect at other points. Is it just taken out of context?
Yeah, and yes, and it's such a dangerous thing to do. This kind of constant swinging pendulum on social media between celebrating heroes and vilifying villains. Yeah, in real life, you know, there aren't many magnificent heroes, and there aren't many significant, you know, aren't many sickening villains. What almost all of us are kind of in the middle, right? And that's the grown-up way of treating human beings, as being dimensional. That beautiful line of Monica Lewinsky's, people forget that I was dimensional. If my book does anything, I hope it just reminds people that people are dimensional.
John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with John Ronson, a journalist, documentary maker, and author. His newest book is called So You've Been Publicly Shamed. Coming up, nearly 9 out of 10 Americans are now covered by health insurance. We'll find out what's drawing more people to find coverage. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is back tomorrow. You're listening to Central Time.